My name is Betsy Anderson. I'm the Executive Director of the American Society of International Law, and it's a great pleasure to be here and collaborating again with the Federalist Society. Those of you who don't know the American Society, we've been around for about 100 years. We have a mission to promote greater understanding of international law, and there's material outside if you're curious about that. Our approach is very much like the Federalist Society, to create a forum for informed, balanced debate about the key issues in our field. And so this is a natural partnership, and very pleased to be here today. And we're fortunate to have a good topic for just such a debate today. We in our international legal field face a persistent set of questions about how international law, that is the law, whether it comes from treaty or custom that binds the United States in its relations with other nations, how that law and how and whether it becomes part of our domestic law. It seems a kind of recurrent theme in certainly society circles. And last year at this conference, we co-sponsored a luncheon discussion about one aspect of that conundrum that's currently before the Supreme Court in the Kiobel case, and looking at how international law might be enforced through the Alien Tort Statute. Today we're going to look at another angle on this question, namely whether there are limits on Congress's power to enact legislation implementing treaties to which the U.S. is a party. Can it exceed the legislative powers that are accorded to Congress in the Constitution, and if so, what are those limits and how do we find them? The question was seemingly asked and answered by the Supreme Court almost 100 years ago in the Missouri versus Holland case, where the court held that if the treaty is valid, the implementing legislation is valid under the Necessary and Proper Clause. But it's been suggested that this holding was wrong and should be overruled. And the question of Congress's power in this connection is increasingly raised, particularly as we see the realm of international law expanding into areas that have traditionally been very much the province of local jurisdictions. So our debate today is provocatively framed as, quote, resolved. Congress's enumerated powers cannot be increased by treaty. And we're fortunate to have two very distinguished constitutional scholars to engage on this topic, with Professor Nicholas Rosenkranz from Georgetown University Law Center arguing in favor of this proposition, that is, that Congress's enumerated powers cannot be increased by treaty, and Professor Richard Pildes of NYU School of Law taking a contrary view. Professor Rosenkranz is, as I mentioned, a professor of law at Georgetown. He also holds posts as a senior fellow at the Cato Institute and the American Enterprise Institute. A graduate of Yale College and Yale Law School, he clerked for Judge Easterbrook of the Seventh Circuit and Justice Kennedy of the Supreme Court, and had a two-year stint in the Office of Legal Counsel at the U.S. Department of Justice before joining Georgetown. His 2005 Harvard Law Review article on executing the treaty power nicely sets the stage for today's debate. Joining Professor Rosenkranz on my left with a different perspective is Professor Richard Pildes, the Sudler Family Professor of Constitutional Law at NYU, a leading scholar of public law and a specialist in the legal issues affecting democracy. Rick is a member of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences and has been recognized as a Guggenheim Fellow and Carnegie Scholar, a graduate of Princeton and Harvard. He clerked for Judge Mikva of the D.C. Circuit and Justice Marshall on the Supreme Court. He began his teaching career at the University of Michigan and moved to NYU in 2000. So welcome to you both. We will have a relatively informal format here, with each of our two speakers initially framing our discussion with some comments, some follow-up questions by me, and back and forth between them, hopefully a lively discussion, and then we'll open it up to all of you to join in that. So we'll begin first by looking to Nick. Tell us what you see as the limits on Congress's powers to execute treaties.
Great. So thank you for that introduction. And the issue is beautifully framed. Just to restate it a bit, if the president enters into a treaty, and it's a non-self-executing treaty, then that's in the nature of a promise. So it promises another nation that we will enact some legislation. And the question is, what happens if the president enters into a treaty to promising to enact some legislation that Congress otherwise would not have power to enact, something that is not within the list in Article 1, Section 8? Does the treaty automatically somehow give Congress that power, even though they couldn't have enacted the statute before? Now they can enact it. And, or to put really the finest point on it, can a treaty increase the power of Congress? Can a treaty increase the power of Congress? Missouri v. Holland seemed to say yes, and I'm wanting to say no, that that's wrong. So Missouri v. Holland, per Justice Holmes, said yes in 1920, but in a five-page opinion with no reasoning really whatsoever, no quotation to relevant constitutional clauses, just a conclusory sentence about it. And I want to say that's wrong. I'm going to make an argument based on text and structure. They're really simple points, really simple textual structural points, and then we'll, I guess, take it from there. So I'm just going to start with the constitutional text. This is thought to, this power is thought to derive from the necessary and proper clause conjoined with the treaty clause. These are the two relevant clauses. So I'm just going to give them to you. Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution the foregoing powers and all other powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Necessary and proper clause. Now, and then the president shall have power, by and with the advice and consent of the Senate, to make treaties, provided two-thirds of the senators present concur. Now, just trying to look at those two clauses in conjunction, the treaty power is a power. Right? It is a power, such a power like the powers referenced in the Necessary and Proper Clause. It's not a foregoing power. The foregoing powers are the earlier ones in Article 1, Section 8, but it's an other power listed in the Constitution. It's listed in Article 2, and so it applies. Necessary and Proper Clause applies to the treaty power. And so you could, as it were, conjoin the two clauses, and here's how they fit together as a matter of grammar. The Congress shall have power to make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution, dot, 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 the president's power to make treaties. That's the way the two clauses fit together. And so our question here is, what's the scope of that power? What's the scope of that power? And what I want to claim is the key words here are the words to make. To make, the power to make treaties. So Congress shall have power, make all laws necessary and proper for carrying into execution the power to make treaties. This would certainly include the power to pass legislation, you know, appropriating money to send somebody to France to negotiate a treaty, or to commission a study about the merits of a treaty, something like that. Power to legislation that would aid the president's power to make the treaty. But that's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about implementing treaties that have already been made. Now, so here is the Supreme Court talking about a similar piece of language, not the treaty clause, but a similar piece of language in a statute. They're talking about the right to make contracts in a statute, the right to make contracts. Kind of similar language in a way, right? It's got that same key infinitive verb to make. And actually, a non-self-executing treaty is kind of in the nature of a contract, really. So, similar piece of language. Here's the court in Patterson. The right to make contracts does not extend as a matter of either logic or semantics to conduct after the contract relation has been established, including breach of the terms of the contract. Such post-formation contract does not involve the right to make a contract, but rather implicates the performance of established contract obligations. The court thought this was an easy point in Patterson, clear distinction between the making of the contract and the performing of the contract. So, so what I want to say as a matter of text is necessary and proper clause plus the treaty power cannot give Congress new power to implement treaties already made. Just a matter of text and grammar. That's the textual point. The structural point I want to make is, you know, it's really a pretty basic structural point. Article 1, Section 8 gives us a list of enumerated powers. So Congress has this list. The Articles 1, 2, and 3, the vesting clauses actually vary a bit. So in Article 1, Section 1, Congress's powers are the powers herein granted. Article 2 and Article 3, they don't have that language, herein granted. Only Article 1 says that. Why? Because Congress's powers are fixed powers. fixed powers, fixed by Article 1, Section 8. President's a little bit different, actually. Congress can increase the power of the president, passing a new statute, giving him something new to do, delegating him some new power. But the president can't increase the power of Congress in return. So that's the explanation for that structural difference. Congress is the fixed star of constitutional power. Its power is fixed by the Constitution. The powers herein granted just would be odd, seems odd as a matter of drafting, to, with such care and precision, write out these 18 items in Article 1, Section 8, if actually the powers of Congress were those 18 powers plus anything that the president could get Zimbabwe to agree to. But that's actually what we're talking about here. So the president and the Senate and Zimbabwe can agree on anything, then Congress gets new power to regulate that thing under Missouri v. Holland. And, you know, these things can be very vague. And the conventional wisdom is that a treaty can be about anything, actually. So, you know, you enter into a treaty with Zimbabwe wherein we agree to regulate the citizenry as we see best or something. And then Congress has plenary legislative power after that under Missouri v. Holland. Seems odd that that would follow, given this list of enumerated powers. I'll just put the structural point in a couple of other ways. You know, one strange implication is, so Congress is on the Missouri v. Holland theory, Congress's power can be increased, right, by treaty. If that seems strange, consider that then Congress's power can also decrease. And isn't that somehow strange? So if the president can abrogate a treaty, and do that unilaterally for any reason or no reason, what happens on the Missouri v. Holland theory? A statute that was constitutional yesterday somehow rendered unconstitutional when the president abrogates the treaty? Isn't that odd to think about? For most statutes, the president has his little shot at them during the veto window, but if he doesn't veto the statute, that's it. His role is complete. These are like an exception to the rule. The president can veto these statutes forever. He just decide, I'm going to abrogate the treaty, and thus the statute will be unconstitutional. Seems like a kind of an odd exception to the general rule. And if that seems odd, consider that the president's not the only one who can abrogate treaties. So our treaty partners can also abrogate treaties. That is, the foreign governments with whom we enter into these treaties. What happens then when the King of England abrogates the treaty? Does that render the statute unconstitutional? It's kind of odd to think that, you know, what would the framers have thought? The first objection in the Declaration of Independence is foreign control over domestic law. When the framers have been surprised to learn that actually a U.S. statute duly passed by both houses of Congress and signed by the president could somehow be rendered unconstitutional by the King of England? Seems odd, really, but this too actually follows from Missouri v. Holland. And then I guess the final point I want to make is, if Missouri v. Holland is right, there's just this quite perverse incentive that I think was utterly inconsistent with the framers' vision. The Missouri v. Holland creates this incentive of the political branches to enter into new international obligations just to get new domestic power. So it's the president and the Senate enhancing the power of the president, Senate, and the House. This is not ambition counteracting ambition. This is ambition being handed the keys to power, right? President and Senate getting to opt to increase their own power. The framers were nervous about international entanglements, and they were nervous about domestic ambition. So the idea that there's going to be these perverse incentives to enter into these international obligations exactly so as to increase domestic legislative power, I think would have horrified the framers. And it's been deeply inconsistent with most of the structural premises of the document. So, you know, in short, as a matter of text and structure, I think it's very hard to defend. I think a treaty cannot increase the legislative power of Congress.
Okay. Thank you very much. Nick, Rick, is he right?
Of course he's not right. So first, let me thank the Federal Society and Lee in particular for bringing me into this event. I'm very glad to be here. And I want to thank Nick for this tremendously provocative article that he did a number of years ago. That certainly has seized on a deep puzzle in American constitutional history and practice and theory. And I've been thinking about these issues in a casual way for a while, ever since Nick's article first appeared. But I don't consider myself a particular expert on the treaty power. But I will do my best to explain why I think Nick's view is ultimately not convincing. I do think Nick is engaged with a problem that is a genuinely deep and puzzling aspect of the Constitution, and it's a subset of the larger set of problems about how the international side, the foreign affairs side of the Constitution, relates to the domestic side of the Constitution. And in starting to think about this problem with the treaty power, I do think it's helpful to remember that ensuring the U.S.'s ability to comply with international agreements, to credibly make and faithfully honor international commitments, was, in fact, one of the central purposes of the establishment of the Constitution. Not just one of many things that the Constitution was designed to achieve, but it was actually one of the very central animating objectives of the Constitution. Because under the Treaty of Paris, which ended the war, the Revolutionary War, the United States had agreed to honor the debts of British creditors the United States, to individuals in the United States. And in return, as part of the treaty, the British agreed to withdraw from various military forts in the Northwest. So this kind of quid pro quo is exactly the kind of deal making that occurs with the end of hostilities, the entering into a peace treaty. But the states, or some states at least, refused to actually comply with these obligations. And the British, as a result, refused to withdraw from these military forts in the Northwest. And so even though these claims, which are ordinary contract or property claims, you know, debts, that the United States had made an agreement to honor as part of the Treaty of Paris, the inability to actually honor that agreement, to carry it out, led the British to refuse to withdraw from these forts and created an ongoing serious national security problem for the United States. And that example and a series of examples very much like this, in which under the Articles of Confederation, the United States entered into various international agreements which it could not faithfully implement and honor and carry out because it was dependent on state legislatures to honor these agreements, was a major concern in the framing of the Constitution. And you can see a variety of provisions that are very specific reflections of this underlying concern. The fact that the states are specifically prohibited from entering into treaties, that the treaty power is exclusively given to the national government. It's not a reserved power in any way under the 10th Amendment. That states cannot enter international compacts without congressional consent. The treaties are expressly made the supreme law of the land. That Article 3 expressly gives federal courts jurisdiction over cases arising under treaties to ensure the effective enforcement of treaties. There are a variety of provisions that were specifically designed to cure the problem that the Treaty of Paris had exemplified, but that had been an ongoing series of problems for a country that considered extremely important for its credit, for its security, to be able to make and enter into international agreements and then honor them. Even in the Constitutional Convention, there was a debate, because this is a puzzle, about whether the treaty power should be limited in some way, and there was a specific decision not to limit the scope of the treaty power because of the uncertainty about what kinds of interests the United States over time would have that would be best realized through treaties. Now, Nick's intuition, or the intuition that I think makes many of us responsive to the concerns that drives Nick's piece, is a powerful intuition from the other side, which is, well, unless there's some limitation on the treaty power, can it really be the case that the United States can now enter into treaties and implement it through domestic legislation that supersedes powers that would otherwise be within the control of the states? Can the balance of domestic lawmaking power be changed in this way? And if there are no limits to this, isn't this, at least in theory, a way for Congress to circumvent the limited enumerated powers in Article 1? And all the human rights treaties since World War II really drive this conundrum home. So I think it's a genuine, a difficult and deep and genuine problem. But I want to now turn to why I think Nick's solution to the problem is not convincing. And I'll try to offer some thoughts about an alternative doctrinal and legal solution, if that's the direction we ought to be looking for a solution to this problem, and maybe then raise some questions about whether that's the right place to look for solutions to this problem altogether. Okay, let me try to quickly go through what I see as four problems with Nick's approach. The first, although he doesn't say it in the comments here, but it's very clear in the article he wrote, Nick does accept that if the President and the Senate choose to make a treaty self-executing, then that treaty can indeed displace the state's traditional legislative powers. Okay, so all of these, you know, rhetorically grabbing sorts of appeals to the perversity of the Senate and the President agreeing to a treaty with Zimbabwe that then allows Congress to enact implementing legislation that it could not otherwise enact, all of those problems remain under Nick's approach, because the Senate and the President can do exactly that as long as they make the treaty self-executing. What they cannot do under this approach is agree that the best way to implement the treaty is to actually leave it to subsequent Congresses, which require the House and the Senate and the President to approve a further piece of legislation. Nick's approach rests on a, or his solution, I would say, rests on a very, very thin thread that all of the weighty concerns about the balance of power between the federal and the state government disappear as long as the Senate and the President make the treaty self-executing. And at least as a structural or functional matter, that seems like an awfully peculiar outcome that's hard to make sense of. Why would the system have been designed with that set of outcomes in mind? Secondly, Nick tries to generate support for his position by pointing out various apparent pragmatic problems that the Missouri versus Holland solution raises, like the ones he just talked about. Doesn't this allow Congress's powers not to be fixed? Can it really be the case that Congress suddenly has powers it doesn't otherwise have because a treaty's been enacted? What happens if the treaty gets repealed or the President revokes it? Does Congress's statute now somehow suddenly disappear? Isn't this all deeply disturbing and puzzling? But I think all of this is not disturbing or not all that puzzling. And I think a very good way to see why it's not is to think about the war powers of the federal government. So there's no question that the existence of a war gives birth to numerous kinds of powers the national government otherwise does not have. And the most obvious example, particularly if you've just seen the Lincoln movie, though it's not the first one I would recommend among the ones that are out there. Zero Dark Thirty and Argo are both much better. But in any event, as you probably know, Lincoln always took the view that the national government did not have the power to abolish slavery where it existed. As a matter of the ordinary domestic allocations of power under the Constitution, the federal government had no power to abolish slavery where it existed. He said that consistently throughout his political career, including as president. But over the course of the war, he came to the view that abolishing slavery in the states that were in rebellion was an important and necessary means of facilitating the Union war effort, and that he had the power, even acting unilaterally, to issue the Emancipation Proclamation. And similarly, during the war, Congress passed the First and Second Confiscation Acts, and these acts authorized the uncompensated confiscation of property in the hands of those in rebellion. And again, there's no question that Congress did not have any kind of domestic legislative power under ordinary circumstances to regulate property issues or to take property without compensation. And yet, as an exercise of the war powers, Congress did validly have this kind of authority. Now, all of the paradoxes that Nick raises about the treaty power could easily be raised about the war power. Well, so does this mean that when the war ends, the confiscation acts are no longer constitutional acts? Yes, I think that's what it means. It seems fairly obvious to me that's what it means. Statutes that are justified by the exercise of another power the Constitution allocates to the national government may be valid when enacted, if legitimately enacted in the pursuit or the realization of that power. But if the conditions that justify the initial exercise of power no longer exist or are formally revoked, then the statute that is justified only as an implementation of that power would also, it seems to me, no longer be constitutional. Does this mean Congress's powers are not fixed in the enumerated list? Well, yeah, in a sense it does. So there's nothing that authorizes Congress to confiscate property or to confiscate property during wartime, but it's long been understood to be a part of the war powers that both the president and the Congress have when a war is in place, in progress. Third problem with Nick's approach, I think, is that he wants to put all of the blame for this structure of Missouri versus Holland on Missouri versus Holland itself. And Nick's right that Missouri versus Holland just has one sentence in a short opinion that's not reasoned and analyzed and argued, that states Congress has the power to implement through domestic legislation a valid treaty. And this is a way of trying to kind of delegitimate the larger position to focus on the fact that it's one unreasoned sentence in one opinion. But I think that that perspective is deeply misleading in terms of American political and constitutional history, because that sentence in Missouri versus Holland is unreasoned and unelaborated precisely because it reflects a long-standing position that, as far as I know, had been universally accepted, certainly in the courts, in the political debates in Congress over many, many years, in the constitutional treatises of the 19th century. It's not that Missouri versus Holland created this position out of thin air and suddenly made it constitutional doctrine. It's that that sentence is a reflection of at least 100 years of political and constitutional practice. And indeed, I'm not aware of any major scholar or political figure taking the position that Nick takes. In fact, I don't know if Nick agrees with this. He may be the first person who's really taken this particular position as a way of trying to solve the treaty problem. And the fourth problem with Nick's views that I wanted to mention at the outset is that his approach doesn't really, to me, provide any meaningful answer to the very profound concerns that led the framers in the first place to put such an emphasis on creating a capacity for the United States to faithfully implement and honor its treaty obligations. Because if you ask, under Nick's approach, well, what is it that the national government is empowered to do to try to ensure that its treaty obligations are faithfully honored? The solution is, as I understand it from Nick's piece, either, number one, rely on the states to implement the treaty, which of course was the very problem that the Constitution was significantly designed to solve, or seek a constitutional amendment that would enable Congress then to legislate to implement the treaty. And I find, as a matter of sort of reasoning about the structure of the Constitution and the way in which it tries to realize its objectives, those to be not very satisfying answers to the question, how can the system credibly commit and faithfully honor international obligations whose faithful carrying out is going to be very central to the ability of the United States to be a significant player in the international stage and protect its interest in various sorts of ways. Okay, now, if I have a couple minutes left still, I'll try to just quickly gesture towards alternative solutions. The problem is a genuine puzzle. It is a conundrum. I recognize that. It's not a false kind of concern. There are reasons to worry about how the international side and the domestic side of the Constitution fit together in this area. If we're looking for a doctrinal solution to it, there are two or three things, it seems to me, that at least in theory are more persuasive ways of trying to go. First is that the court should be serious about scrutinizing, implementing legislation for treaties if that legislation would otherwise not be a valid exercise of one of Congress's enumerated powers. So there ought to be a real meaningful connection between a valid treaty and the implementing legislation. And instead of courts taking a very kind of hands-off-ish approach to that question, I think serious scrutiny of the means and ends connection is justified in that context. Secondly, and at least in theory, it seems to me that conceptually the more appropriate answer to this conundrum has to be the view that there must be some subject matter limitations on the treaty power. And historically, that's been the position that people who have worried about this problem have gravitated toward, despite the fact that the convention explicitly rejected those kinds of limitations. So the Missouri versus Holland statement, a valid treaty then justifies implementing legislation that faithfully carries out the treaty, puts a lot of emphasis on what is a valid treaty, and it seems to me that's the right place to focus. Now, doctrinally, and again, this is in theory, it seems to me there are a couple of ways of implementing some subject matter constraint on the treaty power. One is to require that a treaty not be a pretextual means of trying to achieve domestic legislative power Congress would not otherwise have. Because that's one of the concerns that clearly motivates this puzzle. Now, can that be implemented? Can that be enforced? You know, there are obvious problems with trying to do that, but it seems to me that's a more productive direction, at least, to try to potentially focus. And the second direction is to establish some understanding of what kinds of issues are genuinely matters of international concern that can be made the basis of treaties, and not necessarily to take the view that anything that the President and the Senate want to agree to in substance can be validly made the subject of a treaty. Now, how you implement that judicially is also very, very difficult. And it might be that there are no good doctrinal answers to this deep puzzle, although I think these are more fruitful directions to go than the direction that Nick's piece pursues. And if there isn't a doctrinal solution to this underlying conundrum, then we're left with the usual sets of issues about whether political processes designed to make it very difficult to enter into treaties, the two-thirds requirement for Senate approval, the requirement that any subsequent legislation must go through all three, House, Senate, President, all three institutions to be approved. The fact that, by the way, if you're concerned about this problem, we have actually entered very few treaties in recent decades through the Article II treaty process. And that when we enter these treaties, the Senate often attaches reservations to them, frequently to protect the interests of states, maybe some evidence that this political dynamic actually does more work, more successful work in policing these boundaries than you might think if we just raise the abstract anxieties about whether the treaty power could really license a wholesale kind of repudiation of the domestic political order that the Constitution establishes.
Okay, well, thank you, Rick, for joining the debate very effectively. I'm going to turn to Nick to respond. And particularly, I want to make sure that you respond on the Treaty of Paris problem. How would you solve the difficulty of the United States engaging in commitments abroad that then it is unable to implement at home? How do you deal with the difference with self-executing treaties as opposed to non-self-executing treaties that Rick pointed out? And third, importantly, what's wrong with Rick's alternatives?
Great. So Rick made a ton of worthwhile points, and I'm not sure I have time to answer them all or respond to them all. I guess on the last points first, just to clarify, the current state of play is circuit courts believe they'll do just rational basis scrutiny for the relationship between the statute and the treaty. I certainly think it would be an improvement to have a more rigorous analysis if Missouri v. Holland were not overruled. So we definitely agree about that. Subject matter limitations on the treaty power, this article's agnostic about that. And, you know, I think there's things to be said about that, but it's very hard to figure out quite what should be considered a legitimate treaty for purposes of the treaty clause. So I think that's there's lots of interesting scholarship about that, but this article is really agnostic about that. I do think trying to figure out whether the treaty's a pretext or whether the political branches have entered into it just to attain legislative power, I think that's going to be close to impossible. I think any given treaty is going to probably be partially motivated by some, you know, bona fide international, you know, instinct, but also partially motivated, as, you know, most politicians are about most things, by a desire for power, right? Unsurprising. And quite how you're going to parse that and say, well, I think it was, you know, 70% motivated by the legitimate reason and 30%, so I'm not sure that's going to work. But I'm glad we agree that there is a real problem here, and that there are, and that we are at least thinking in the same direction about what kind of limits there might be. And so I'll just make a couple of points. And just one thing I'd like to point out is we did not hear a textual argument. We didn't hear a textual argument. So I'm curious, I mean, Rick, do you agree, maybe you could take on it, do you agree that the clauses at issue here are the necessary and proper clause and the treaty clause? And do you find this power within those two clauses, or are you finding it elsewhere, I guess, is what I would wonder. But for now, we don't know what quite the textual argument is for this. To me, it says only to make treaties. Now, though, Rick has made an extremely important point, and a point that has a huge amount of intuitive appeal, and so it's probably the most important thing to respond to. This is the intuition here, and it absolutely did drive the framers, and I think it drives the intuitions to this day. It's the idea of, under my view, the president can enter into a treaty that the Senate can ratify, promising to do something that Congress lacks the power to do. Is that crazy? Is it crazy to imagine that we've set up a structure wherein we can enter into international legal obligations and then be powerless to enforce them, or have maybe not powerless, but have some options which are some unattractive options for enforcing such obligations? And that has a huge amount of intuitive appeal, but I think if you think about it more, you'll realize there's actually not anything terribly odd about this. Maybe you've had a conversation like this with your child. You might have said to your child, it's really important to keep your promises. It's very important to honor your promises. And then years later, your child came home and said, can I take the car out to go joyriding with my friends at 2 a.m? And you've said, no, of course you can't. And the child says, but I promised my friends. And you said it's really important to honor your promises. Now, has any parent ever been fooled by this? Any parent ever then say, quite right, here are the keys? No. What is it? The rule has a corollary. The rule has a corollary. Yes, it's very important to honor your promises. How do you do that? Don't make promises you can't keep. Don't make promises that you don't have power to keep. It's quite easy. Quite easy, actually. So the treaties, what the president should do is enter into treaties that we have the power to implement, not enter into treaties where we don't. This is not such a crazy idea, I don't think. You know, I may try to make that point just in a couple of other ways. Again, it might seem crazy. We enter into this treaty and now we don't have power to implement it. We're suddenly in breach of our international legal obligations. This can happen in all kinds of ways under current doctrine already. I just want to make that clear. So first thing that can happen is the House could rebel. President signs the treaty, Senate ratifies, and the House says we don't want any part of this. Suddenly, we are in breach of that international legal obligation. Is that so crazy? It's built into the system. That can happen. They knew that that could happen. There have been debates over the years about what the House's responsibility is. Are they kind of morally obliged to implement such a treaty? But, you know, as a matter of fact, they, of course, can rebel and not, implement the treaty. Consider we could enter a treaty that's simply impossible as a matter of fact for us to implement. You promise to, whatever, send somebody to Jupiter next year or something. You can make the promise, legit treaty, but you actually lack the power to do it. Is it crazy to imagine that the scope of your ability to promise exceeds the scope of your ability to implement promises? Doesn't seem crazy to me. Rick refers to an example that I use as a possible solution. In extreme cases, you could imagine that we made a promise to amend the Constitution. Of course, it's very far-fetched, and it really shouldn't happen. But, you know, as a matter of kind of formal structural logic, there's no reason why we shouldn't be able to make such a promise. These promises generally are promises to use a particular part of the Constitution. If we promise we're going to enter into legislation, we are promising we'll use our Article 1, Section 7 mechanism to get some things done. Okay. Why is it crazy to imagine that we could enter into a treaty where we'd say, we're going to use this other Article 5 mechanism to get some things done? Again, you can make the promise. Again, you may or may not actually execute the promise. Those are going to be harder ones to keep, but no theoretical reason why you shouldn't be able to make that set of promises too. Your treaty partners ought to be skeptical that you're going to, you know, follow through on such a promise, but no theoretical reason why that couldn't be such a promise. So that doesn't seem crazy to me. Many other points worth responding to, but you wanted me to talk in particular about self-executing treaties. Rick makes a great point here. It is true that self-executing treaties can go beyond the enumerated powers of Congress, or at any rate, that's the current thinking, and I don't dispute that. A self-executing treaty can reach beyond the enumerated powers of Congress. Doesn't that, though, create all the same problems that I'm talking about, and so doesn't that undermine my whole argument? I don't think it quite does, and here's why. A self-executing treaty that's going to be a domestic law of its own force is just going to have a different nature. It's going to read a lot more like law, and read a lot more like a code. So, a self-executing treaty that was a kind of a code of family law, say. We're going to regulate in the best interest of the child, and so here's the code of family law that we're going to implement here by treaty. You can imagine states would rebel. You can imagine state senators are going to rebel, and governors are going to be calling their senators and saying, wait a second, this is going to preempt all kinds of state family law. Implausible that we're going to enter into that sort of treaty. The non-self-executing version, though, is much more insidious. The non-self-executing treaty is written in these utterly aspirational terms. It says something like, you know, we're going to regulate families in the best interest of the child or something, period. And when your governor calls your senator and says, wait a second, what is this thing? The Senate says, oh, don't worry. It's basically just aspirational, and all of your state laws are already in compliance with this. So it's not going to have actually any domestic law force at all. We're really just doing it because we're trying to get Zimbabwe to change its law. But don't worry, everything here is fine. Senators are convinced by that, sign the thing. 10 years, 20 years later, perhaps, the federal government decides, Congress decides, you know what? It might be nice to have a big whole code of U.S. family law. They have the power per this treaty. They reassured their senators it wasn't going to change any state law, but nevertheless, it lies around like a smoking gun, and lies around like a loaded gun, and the Congress can pick it up and regulate family law per this treaty if we enter into such a treaty. So I just think it's much more likely to actually extend Congress's power in a kind of insidious way than the self-executing treaty. So I think that's really the difference. I don't know.
Treaty of Paris.
Well, I think the Treaty of Paris point is the first point.
Is the kid with the car keys.
Okay.
Yeah, I'd say yes, the framers were very worried about this, and so they created a system where we could enter into treaties. They could be self-executing, so our treaty partners could know they'd be executed, or they could be non-self-executing, and our treaty partners would be taking a gamble that we either would use the Article 1 process or the Article 5 process in order to implement them. But this doesn't seem anything terribly anomalous about that. Oh, and then just on the on whether I'm putting too much weight on Missouri v. Holland, it's 5 pages long, but there's not this unbroken assumption that this was the state of the world. What there is kind of dicta that points in both directions. But you know, just if you'd like an example, Mayor of New Orleans versus United States, 1836. The government of the United States is one of limited powers. It can exercise authority over no subjects except those which have been delegated to it. Congress cannot, by legislation, enlarge the federal jurisdiction, nor can it be enlarged under the treaty-making power, 1836. Now, I don't put a lot of weight on this because this is dicta, really, and not very reasoned either. But, you know, I guess I want to say the dicta pre-Missouri v. Holland kind of is a draw. And that's why you've never heard of that case, but you have heard of Missouri v. Holland. That's really the holding on this. So.
Okay. Rick, do you want to respond, maybe particularly on the textual point? Do you have a...
Sure. So first of all, I think that it should be clear from the comments I was making, I view myself as kind of the originalist here on this issue. I think subsequent political practice is consistent with the original vision here, and I think Missouri versus Holland is consistent with that original vision. And I think that the Senate and the President entering into international agreements should not be thought of as 16-year-old kids driving a car for a joyride. Because I don't think that there's a serious, that this is not a serious solution to the Treaty of Paris problem to say, well, tough luck, sometimes, you know, you just can't make that agreement. Because that essentially is what I heard Nick saying. About what his vision of how the Constitution solved the Treaty of Paris problem was. And I think that this really does require an answer because it was such a serious force driving the design of the Constitution, the Treaty of Paris kind of problem. On the specific issue about textualism and Nick's textual arguments, I actually am, you know, sort of pretty strongly committed to the importance of constitutional text and legislative text. But I think what Nick's doing here is a little bit different from the way we ordinarily understand textualism. So ordinarily, at least what I'm thinking about, is, you know, a set of provisions that are the product of a fairly focused set of deliberations. At the end of the deliberations, there's a set of provisions that speak to that particular problem. And that solution should be given the effect that the words embody, in my view. What Nick's doing here is different, though, because what he's doing is he's taking a piece of text that's over in Article 2 of the Constitution, the treaty power, and a piece of text from Article 1, the necessary and proper clause, and saying, now, if you actually kind of put these together side by side and read them as if they were written as one sentence, you know, it turns out the only power Congress has been given is the power to give, you know, provide money to be able to make a treaty, but not to be able to actually implement that treaty. And I think that that's a kind of textual parsing that just to me is a very, I'm not very moved by the view that the framers, in seeking to solve the kinds of problems I was discussing, you know, actually created a solution that isn't expressed in a particular provision, but if you patch this together with this over here, you know, somehow what falls out is a solution that seems, on functional and pragmatic and structural grounds, really hard to make sense of as a rational architectural choice that the framers might have made, and that doesn't solve the primary problem they were trying to solve in the international area, which is to empower the United States to make and faithfully carry out its international obligations. So I'm not, although I am a believer in the importance of text, I think this is kind of, this is not textualism as I ordinarily understand it. And I don't think it makes sense to really read the Constitution in this particular literal parsing of different provisions that you patch together into a sentence that was never put together in that way to begin with. It's inevitable that these, all of the various possibilities and the conjunction of various sorts of powers were not deliberated through and rationally decided on and expressed in the kind of language that gets scattered over several different parts of the Constitution. At least I don't think so. Now, if it was a compelling account, if it made sense as a solution to the problem they were trying to solve, if it was a view that lots of people expressed in that period or early constitutional history, it might be different. But all Nick has to rely on, I think, is the fact that we do have a difficult conundrum here, and that if you parse together these two passages in this way, you can have this particular solution fall out. I don't think it's very convincing to say, well, even non-self-executing treaties under the Missouri versus Holland view still require the House to be willing to actually implement the legislation that would carry out the treaty obligation, and therefore it's no different to have 50 state legislatures be the only way in which the treaty obligation can be carried out. Again, the whole point of the way the Constitution was designed with respect to the treaty power and foreign affairs was to put national institutions in the position of being able to make and carry out these obligations based on the view that it at least was more likely that national institutions, including the House, you know, would be oriented toward the national interest in implementing treaties, even if not perfectly so, but certainly much more so than all of the state legislatures, which experience had shown were much more motivated by a variety of parochial and local kinds of interests. And so, yes, I think it is radically different for a foreign country to have to depend on the goodwill of 50 state legislatures in order for the United States' obligations to be faithfully carried out than it is to have to rely in a non-self-executing context on the national political institutions faithfully carrying out the obligations of the treaty. So let me just stop there.
Okay. We have an opportunity to get past the abstract and the hypothetical and talk about a specific case that suggests the specter of power creep that I think you're warning about, and that's the Bond versus the United States case currently pending for cert. And Nick, you're amicus in the case. Why don't you describe it and tell us kind of what you think is going on there?
Yeah, let me do that. I do want to just respond really quickly to a point Rick made. So it is my view the tough luck view. Tough luck, you just can't enter into this treaty because there won't be any power to implement it, and is that crazy? I want to say that's already current doctrine. That's already current doctrine. It's in a case called Reed v. Covert. And I'm sure Rick agrees with this. So can the president enter into a treaty wherein we promise that we will not have any op-eds published that criticize Zimbabwe? Can we enter into such a treaty? Yes, we can. We can enter into such a treaty. Does Congress thus get the power to pass such legislation? No, of course it does not. The First Amendment forbids Congress from doing this. So what do we say? We say tough luck. If you're tempted by that treaty, yes, you could enter into it. You will not be able to execute it unless you can get a constitutional amendment. That is the state of the world on Reed v. Covert. Reed v. Covert says if we promise by treaty to violate the Bill of Rights, Congress doesn't thereby get power to violate the Bill of Rights. I'm just saying the same thing about the enumerated powers. We enter into a treaty promising to do things that Congress lacks the power to do, either because they're forbidden to do it in the First Amendment or because they just lack the power in Article 1, Section 8. Yeah, they don't have power to do it. But half of that story is already doctrinally true. So this is overruling Missouri v. Holland is really just bringing this into harmony with this other case, Reed v. Covert. So I guess I think it's important to get that on the table, Reed v. Covert. So Bond, should we do? So there's this case pending now. It's fantastic because it has such lurid facts. So Mrs. Bond discovers that her husband is having an affair with the neighbor. And so Mrs. Bond does what anyone would do under the circumstances, which is she goes and gets some toxic chemicals and spreads them on the doorknob of the neighbor and I think on like the car door and maybe the mat outside.
Postal inspectors.
Excellent. Yes, exactly.
Could,
right.
Could
yes.
Engage.
Yes, exactly. The post, the mailbox. And the neighbor becomes ill but does not die. And this is obviously all kinds of different state crimes. But an ambitious assistant U.S. attorney goes ahead and charges her under the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act. Okay. The Chemical Weapons Convention, obviously written not quite with these facts in mind, right? They were really kind of imagining more of a terrorism story, I think, as they were writing this thing. But seems to fit, you know, seems to fit under the terms of the statute. And the AUSA prosecuted her, and she says, where does Congress get power to enact this thing? What I have done here is not commerce. Where is the power? Now, the government made a kind of an interesting strategic choice. This is happening in 2010. And the government actually decided not to really focus on the Commerce Clause. I think because they were nervous about the healthcare case. So I think they actually didn't want to press on the Commerce Clause point while the healthcare case was pending. And they thought the treaty point was easy. So they said it doesn't matter quite what the scope of the Commerce Clause is, because of course we have power to implement this. See the Chemical Weapons Convention. It gives us the new power to pass this thing. And the Third Circuit said, yes, that's right. You get that power, see Missouri v. Holland. But it generated three opinions in the Third Circuit, including a very nice concurrence by Judge Ambrose, in which he said, I urge the Supreme Court to take this up and look at this again. This seems crazy to us. And so the case is now, there's a cert petition pending at the Supreme Court, and it's been pending now for, we were just talking about this earlier, it's been relisted five times, which is somewhat unusual. So it at least tells us that some justices are taking this seriously and giving it some thought. So that gives you a kind of live set of facts to latch onto.
And Rick, how do your alternatives solve the bond problem?
Well, I think that the federal statute that prohibits the use and possession of chemical weapons, which apparently extends to these are highly, highly toxic chemicals, by the way. This is a woman who worked in for Rohm and Haas, this industrial chemical manufacturer, Ms. Bond. And apparently, I'm reading from the government's brief, but a mere few crystals of the material she used would be lethal to a child. And the woman she was using this against actually had a young child, and it was on her car door and things like that. So, it's an amazing case in all sorts of ways, especially because it presses the Missouri versus Holland issue in the way it does. But I had never understood why the government had abandoned, at the earlier stages of this, the Commerce Clause and the Foreign Commerce Clause justifications for this statute. And I don't know if Nick's explanation is right, but it's the first one I've heard, and it's very interesting, because now, in the Supreme Court, the government is arguing that this case doesn't even present the Missouri versus Holland issue, because this statute is fairly obviously like statutes on biological weapons and similar kinds of statutes, justified under the Commerce Power, under the Foreign Commerce Clause power. And so the question isn't even presented here. Secondly, if the question, is presented, this does seem like a pretty far extension of any set of concerns that the treaty could be about. And I would be certainly sympathetic to the court trying to find a way out of this situation if the Commerce Clause doesn't otherwise justify the statute. If there's a credible reading of the treaty that makes the treaty not a valid source of authority for legislation as applied in this particular kind of context, that seems to me an appropriate and even desirable direction for the court to consider going. And I wouldn't be surprised if at least some justices are attracted to a solution like that. But I don't think the solution to this kind of problem or any other of these problems is the view that Congress cannot legitimately and appropriately implement a valid treaty, that it doesn't have the power to do that if it would have to exercise power that the states otherwise have. Period.
Okay. You want to? I think we're running short of time. You can get an answer in. Maybe go while people find a microphone and start raising hands.
I just wanted to ask, Chris. So, do you agree with Ruby V. Covert?
You know, I've always thought that's a more puzzling situation than the way the case treats it. I think that's your best, that's actually the best thing you have on your side of the argument. I'm not sure that that view is right across the board. I mean, it is the doctrine. You're certainly reciting the doctrine, you know, accurately and fairly, that a treaty cannot empower Congress to legislate in a way that would otherwise violate the Bill of Rights, individual provisions of the Bill of Rights. And by the way, I think that would extend to commandeering of states. Mm-hmm. So at least that aspect of federalism, which is a kind of an independent immunity of the states, would presumably fall under Reed versus Covert, would be covered the same way as Reed versus Covert.
But
the legislative powers, the reallocation of legislative powers through a treaty so that the federal government can enforce its treaty obligations, I think can certainly be seen to be a qualitatively different situation than issues about individual rights, even individual rights of states, if we think of commandeering that way. But I don't know if push came to shove and we really had situations that pushed the boundaries of Reed versus Covert, whether the court would actually embrace that all the way down the line. So I don't know if in order to solve a war, you know, a major war, real national security threats to the United States, we had to agree to something. Certainly most troubling if it's a First Amendment kind of provision, but something that would otherwise violate the Bill of Rights. You know, maybe the government would be empowered to, I don't know what a good example here would be. I was thinking about seizing guns or something like that. I'm not sure. You know, it was Reed v. Covert was an easy case to decide. We weren't giving away anything of any international significance. The court could stand up for the Bill of Rights. So you're right to raise it. I think there's a distinction that's been long recognized about power versus individual rights. But I also just don't know whether, when push comes to shove, Reed versus Covert would really hold up all the way down the line.
Wow.
Okay. Right there, Tyler.
Thank you. Thank you both for doing this. Nick, I thought Rick's strongest point was about the self-executing treaties and how it just seems bizarre that everything you don't think they should be able to do to the non-self-executing, they can do to the self-executing. Your response was you think it's less like this aggrandizement is less likely to happen in the self-executing context because the states can call their senators, but the states can call their senators during the phase where they're implementing legislation just as well. So it strikes me that, in fact, not only is it less likely to occur in the self-executing realm, I think it's actually more likely to occur there because it's easier to do. In the self-executing realm, you only need the president and the Senate to do it. In the non-self-executing realm, you're going to need the president and the Senate and then ultimately the House to go along with it through the implementing legislation. So I do think we're left in a situation where the Congress can do this to the self-executing way, maybe even easier than they can do it through the other way. And I'm wondering, is there any functional reason why we would think that they wanted to allow this to happen through the self-executing way, but not the non-self-executing way? Or is this just an irrational textual quirk?
Let's grab maybe two or three questions and then answer them together right here.
Rick, this is a question for you. I've never heard the argument against Nick's position, and you've made a very powerful argument against Nick's position, and I want to thank you for doing that. I really learned a lot. I guess my question is, in response to Nick's query of you as to what the textual basis for this power is, I heard from you a response about textualism in general. Then I heard from you a critique of Nick's reading of the text as being somehow convenient and not based on. But I still didn't hear your explanation of what text you're relying on. So however you do textualism, I'd kind of still like to know the answer to Nick's question as to what is the text you think does justify Congress expanding its power, the Senate and the President expanding the power of Congress.
Okay, and a couple of questions at the next table. Yeah.
Thank you both. That was a wonderful discussion.
I'm not a constitutional law scholar, not even close to it, so I may be a little off base on this question, but I'd ask each of you if you have a comment on that. Is it seems to me there's some parallelism between the treaty power and the necessary and proper clause on the one hand, and on the other hand, the taxing and spending power that we saw emerge in the affordable health care legislation, in the sense that it seemed that the Congress's power to spend money exceeded its power, its enumerated powers, in a way that I found a little troubling. And this seems to be a parallel situation, at least if we accept your view, Rick, because Congress would have more power under the treaty power than it would under under its enumerated powers. And am I off base, or isn't there some interesting parallelism there?
Okay. And John, did you have a question?
Simple question. What about an argument, this is to Nick, that actually allowing this implementation does help the president make treaties because it increases his power to make treaties? So even accepting that reading of necessary with the treaty clause.
Okay. Got those? You want to start, Nick?
Sure. Okay. I might have missed one in there. But self-executing versus non-self-executing, is that just a textual quirk, or is there a logic to it? You know, I guess I could just, I think I've said what I want to say about that, you know, except to point out that the post-World War II history is pretty consistent with what I'm describing. So virtually every human rights, I think every, actually, human rights treaty that we've entered into since World War II, we've made a point that the language is extremely vague, and we've made a point of insisting that these things be non-self-executing, and we've gone way out of our way to assure the states that these things don't change domestic law at all. So this is actually is a bit of a pattern, and that seems to be how we get these treaties ratified, is by promising, that by having them be real vague and by promising they don't change domestic law, of their own force. But that's not to say that they won't tomorrow. It's not to say Congress won't then use this new power tomorrow. And, you know, that seems to be what's, you know, then we get the Chemical Weapons Convention Implementation Act or whatever it is. You know, it hasn't come up that much because the Commerce Clause is so vast. So from, you know, from 1937 to 1995, Congress could do anything it wanted under the Commerce Clause. But now, as soon as the court marks off anything that Congress lacks the power to do, you immediately see a ton of law review articles that say, ah, well, maybe we could do it under a treaty. And there are many such articles. They're all cited in here. So there, I think there's scholars at least love this idea that this is going to be an end run around any limit that the Supreme Court comes up with. Maybe I'll. Do you want to take? I think the second one was to you.
I think Randy's question was to me. Yeah, and that's a fair question. You're right. I didn't actually specifically address that issue. What I would say is, you know, first, the necessary and proper clause to me gives Congress the power to implement the Article II power of making treaties. All powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States. So the law has to be necessary and it has to be proper, and I think those terms should have content. But I think that if you are looking for a textual basis for this, I would find it in the necessary and proper clause. Now, I would also be willing to rely on a basic kind of structural inference here as well, which is that, you know, having allocated this power to the national government, the national government has the power to actually implement the power granted to enter into treaties in a way that, you know, makes them credible commitments. So it would be both the text of the necessary and proper clause and the structural inference, which I don't think is a very big leap here.
But and do you mean the text of the necessary and proper clause conjoined with the treaty power in Article II? Is that what you mean? That it is necessary and proper to bring into execution the power to make treaties?
But not reading the treaty power in Article II in, you know, such a kind of narrow and literalistic way that what it means is only the power to make a treaty. It means the power to make a treaty that can be effectively honored. And I don't think that's a deeply mysterious reading. I mean, you know, if you could show me that they actually had debates in which they talked about whether we should also let the federal government have the capacity to honor a treaty it makes, and no, we don't want to give it that power, we just want to give it the power to make a treaty, you know, then I might be more open to the claim. But I think it's so far and away the kind of obvious and commonsensical reading of the necessary and proper clause, especially given all of these structural and functional considerations and the purposes of the way in which these powers over international affairs and treaties were designed, and as I say, no one batted an eye on either side in Congress with all of the treaties in the 19th century that gave Congress the power to do things it did not otherwise have the power to do on the basis of this kind of an argument. So, that's my answer to Randy.
Okay.
I just want to say on that last point that the debate on the Louisiana Purchase had many of these features, including senators who were saying things very much like what I'm saying here, and you can find those quoted in here.
That the treaty was valid, but there was no power to implement it by legislation?
Correct. It was part of the debate about the.
Well, I don't remember seeing that in your article, so I'll go back and look. Okay, I'll look at the passages.
That's in here. But maybe your textual point is maybe a segue to John McGinnis's question. So John says, even if you conjoin the two clauses the way I want to conjoin them, necessary and proper to bring into execution the power to make treaties, maybe a statute implementing a treaty in a way enhances the president's power to make treaties. You could say maybe to make the next treaty, right? The next treaty. So France will be more likely to enter into the next treaty with us once they see that we've implemented this prior treaty. And I do consider that argument in here, but I think it ultimately it proves too much. So I think if you were to imagine a case that's not imagine the cleanest possible version of that case. So a foreign government like France just declares straight up, we simply will not enter into any treaties with you until you regulate, say, guns near schools. Okay, well, it is now true that if Congress were to pass a statute regulating guns near schools, despite Lopez, that would, in a sense, enable the president to enter into some treaties with France that he can't otherwise enter into. But that can't be right. It can't be that France is a naked demand from a foreign country to have some legislation on the books can then make that legislation necessary and proper. I think it proves too much. Another way to see the point is think about the necessary and proper clause joined with the appointments power. So Congress also has power to bring into execution all laws necessary and proper to bring into execution the president's appointments power. I could imagine the president goes to goes to Elena Kagan and says, I'd like to appoint you to the Supreme Court. And she says, I won't take it unless you regulate the guns near schools. It can't be that somehow there's now power to regulate, to Congress gets new power just because it would enable the president to do something that he otherwise, can't do under Article II. So I think it is worth considering, but I think ultimately it proves too much. I don't think it can be right.
Do you want to answer the spending and taxing power question, or do you want? Is it more to me? I think of it as a question more towards Nick, but I'll respond. Yeah, those are actually nice examples because it's long been understood, there was controversy about it, but it's fairly settled now, that Congress can use the spending power or the taxing power for purposes that are not within the scope of the enumerated powers. So if it's validly exercising those powers, it's not confined to the ends under the list of enumerated powers. So I gather what you're asking is, why is the treaty power so different? Or why should we be so worried that this is different? Just like with respect to the war powers examples, which we haven't talked about very much. So I thought that was a question that's directed more towards Nick's view, actually, if I understood the question correctly.
Really directing it one way or the other, just asking either of you to comment on it.
Well, I'm not sure that I have a comment on it. I mean, I guess I'd say the spending power is an enumerated power in Article 1, Section 8, and we could debate about what its scope is, but its scope doesn't change. Its scope is the on current doctrine, it goes beyond the list in Article 1, Section 8. It doesn't change, and crucially, political actors can't change it. The president can't somehow do something new to change the scope of that power, and that's what's different. That's what's different.
But so what about the war power example then? Because that's obviously a situation where the president, using military force, with or without a declaration of war from Congress, can certainly change the powers of Congress, as well as his own powers. That's the Emancipation Proclamation example.
Well, I agree. That's an interesting set of questions. I mean, I guess I want to say about that first. You know, I'm hesitant to draw too much from the Civil War examples. So it's clearly kind of constitutional anomalies in a lot of different ways at that particular moment in history. So I'm not sure I want to draw too much from...
Those are just dramatic examples, but it's not anomalous that throughout U.S. history, if there's a war, the Congress and the President have war powers that get activated that allow them to do things they cannot do under domestic law or under ordinary circumstances. There's nothing anomalous about that. That's the basic fact of how the war powers work.
Well, I guess I think that facts on the ground could conceivably change the scope of legislative power, but that's quite different from saying that political actors themselves can enhance their own power by signing a particular document. So, yeah, maybe like a, you know, maybe a hurricane.
Like a declaration of war?
Well, but as you say, it doesn't have to be a declared war. It has to be some facts.
All right. Tough questions. Great discussion. Thank you all for being here, and thanks to our speakers for a really...